Audit and Human Service Budget Reform to order. Today is January 27th, and we will continue with our informational format. We are having invited testimony only, and for those of you intrepid souls that have been here the entire time, you know that pretty much consumes the full hour and a half or so. Today we're going to begin with Bob DePriet again, who is going to offer us an outline, an overview. But Bob, before we get to you, let me turn it over to staff to have them make a couple announcements about the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Chair. In your packet are two agendas, one for the Senate Judiciary, one for the House Judiciary Committees on January 29th. At 9 a.m. on the 29th, the Senate will be doing a 9 a.m. Presentation of people with mental illness in the criminal justice system, and then there'll be a repeat of that same presentation at 1 o'clock on the House side. It's being done from a kind of a public safety perspective, but we'll focus a lot on the issues that revolve around, again, the large number of people who end up in and out of the criminal justice system. So you're all invited to attend. If anybody from here is going to attend and can give them advance notice, they'll get a nameplate at the dais for you.
And the chair would echo those remarks with the encouragement that if the schedule possibly allows, this is an integral piece of what we're all doing. So if there's any way you can attend, and I know we don't have our schedules in front of us, I think that would really aid the process of the committee. So having said that, let me turn it back over to Mr. DePriet and Dr. Goldberg, who are going to present a basic outline or recap some of the important highlights we've gone through so far. And let me turn it over to Dr. Goldberg and Mr. DePriet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bob DePriet. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Office for Oregon Policy and Research. And I wanted today to do three things, really. First, to summarize at least the major points that were brought up in the 2 days of presentation last week. And then to give you a quick status report on our developing answers to some of the questions that you asked last week. And then we wanted to ask you what clarifications you might want on the materials that were presented last week, or if you have additional questions, or if you just wanted to have some general discussion. And that's what we have in mind. In summarizing what we presented last week, I guess I wanted to start by reminding you that we're currently experiencing very powerful pressures that are building on Medicaid, Medicare, and private insurance, not just in Oregon, but nationally. The way this is showing up with the Medicaid program, which, as you know, is in Oregon, the Oregon Health Plan, is that more people are eligible because of the downturn in the economy. We have more Oregonians who meet the eligibility standards for the Oregon Health Plan, and so enrollment is growing. We also are experiencing steeply increasing costs per person enrolled. So not only do we have more people in the program, but the cost per person is going up. And we also know, as we have from the beginning of the Oregon Health Plan, that when providers are paid less than the cost of care, cost shift results. And the problem with cost shift is that it hides the true cost of care, makes it very difficult to get a handle on them, and requires those who are paying for health care to pay a portion of the share for those who aren't. In Medicare, the pressures are much the same as in Medicaid. In Medicare as well, we have more people becoming eligible as the population ages. Costs per person are also rising steeply, and the pressure on provider payments is also building to make certain that they're sufficient to cover the cost of care. In private insurance, we have some similar dynamics going on. It's important to remember that what happens in private insurance is similar to what happens in Medicaid. In both cases, you have a purchaser of care trying to get the best bargain possible and get access to care for the people that who are going to be covered. In the private sector, we just touched on some of the basic characteristics because you'll be hearing a presentation later this week from Mr. Rocky King, who's the administrator of the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, that will go into more detail on private health insurance. But basically, employer-sponsored insurance is beginning to erode as employers respond to premium increases by either stopping offering health insurance at all because they can't afford to, or by reducing their contributions because they can no longer afford to contribute as much toward the cost of health insurance. And with employees, we see trends that more employees are turning down health insurance that's being offered by the employer because their share of the premium is too high. They can't afford it. Now, individual insurance is also facing steep premium increases, and this is leading to more people dropping coverage that they had on the individual insurance side. And as people leave insurance, whether they're leaving it from employer and sponsored group insurance or from individual insurance, they often turn to the high-risk program, which in Oregon is called the Oregon Medical Insurance Program, to get back into the insured population. And this increases the assessment on insurance premiums that funds the high-risk pool. Now, these pressures are producing...
Okay, explain that last one, because what are the criteria for being in the high-risk pool?
Again, this is something that you'll be hearing more detail on later in the week, but I'll give you a quick summary, and then if I leave something...
I guess that just kind of threw me. You have to present with a level of illness or need, don't you, to qualify. So I guess everything you were saying up till now points me to the fact that the situation's exacerbating itself because we're adversely selecting everywhere across the spectrum. So, okay, and I can wait on that till Rocky's up to explain the details of that.
Representative Cruz, Mr. Chair, I agree with you. We're increasing the adverse selection problem because of these pressures with the high-risk pool. My point was just that when people leave insurance, whether they had it through group insurance or individual insurance, when they reapply, if they do, very often they have a pre-existing condition that means they get turned down on the individual market, and then they would have to go to the high-risk pool. I guess the major point to be made is that the fundamental problem facing the funding of health insurance, whether it's in the private or the public sector, is that health insurance costs are rising very steeply with double-digit increases over the past few years. The economy is stagnant, and this means that businesses are struggling to survive and employees are facing flat earning. Each year that wages remain flat and businesses fight to survive increases the chances that as the cost of health insurance go up, it will not be sustainable for either the businesses or the employees. In other words, we have an increase in the cost of health insurance without a corresponding increase in the ability of employers to offer it and contribute to it, and a corresponding increase in the purchasing power of employees to accept that coverage when it's offered. The result is more people losing employer-sponsored insurance, either because employers are not offering it or because the employees cannot afford the premium increases. And the gap between rising health insurance costs and the purchasing power of employers and employees is growing. Again, this is something we can expect to continue as long as the general economy stays stagnant, flat, and we have these significant increases each year in the cost of health insurance premiums. Now, the problem for the Oregon Health Plan in particular is that just as more people are seeking coverage through the Oregon Health Plan, state revenues are declining. And the cost for each person enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan is going up. So we're getting caught in a dynamic that has diminishing revenues available to pay for the Oregon Health Plan and increasing numbers of people who are becoming eligible and applying. Now, later in the week, we're going to hear in some detail about the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, and the only point I wanted to make today, that this is a very promising solution for many low-income Oregonians, but not for very many impoverished Oregonians below federal poverty level. The reasons for this are that relatively few below the federal poverty level have employer-sponsored insurance available. People with jobs that offer health insurance generally make enough so they're not below federal poverty level. So for this group, group coverage is generally not available. In addition, many of those with very low incomes, say below 50% of federal poverty level, have chronic health conditions that mean that they would be eligible for the high-risk pool, the OMIP program, if they were to apply through FEOP on the individual side. And finally, for many people with very low incomes, their primary concern is getting access to health care, even to routine health care, whereas the private insurance system is typically designed primarily to make sure that cost sharing is not too high and that the financial liability of the patient is limited. So you have a population whose needs and concerns really have to do with getting in to see primary care providers as much as anything else. And on the FEOP program, you have a program that is designed to assist people in being able to afford employer-sponsored insurance or individual insurance so that their health care costs aren't so high they can't afford them. Those two are not always a good match. In general, over the last two presentations, we've attempted to identify the major characteristics and trends in healthcare financing and delivery. And these characteristics and trends can help to frame the key policy issues that need to be addressed in restructuring the Oregon Health Plan. We've not identified a solution to the problems facing the Oregon Health Plan. We don't have one. We hope to be part of the ongoing discussions that will lead to a successful restructuring of the Oregon Health Plan during this legislative session. And to help with that, we stand ready at the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research to provide any information or analysis that will help the legislature accomplish that restructuring.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Markley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In this kind of broad overview, are there any states that have been given permission to essentially provide the participants in their Medicaid demonstration project with a subsidy that they use in the private market rather than a specific defined insurance plan such as the Oregon Health Plan?
Representative Merkley, Mr. Chair, yes. Oregon's not the only state that subsidizes private health insurance. Massachusetts has a program that's been in effect for some years. And there are two or three other states. Oregon is unique, though, in that we've been able to enroll many more people, given the size of the population of Oregon, than other states. But it is an approach that's proven successful in Oregon and in other states.
Mr. Chair, let me clarify that question. What I was getting at is, in the Oregon Health Plan, we define what that health plan is and what's covered and so on and so forth. But a more radical approach would be a subsidy to qualifying families, a subsidy that is simply a voucher, if you will, that could be used in a private market and thereby produce a variety of different plans competing for the business of the low-income families, if you will. Have any states been allowed to do anything like that within the demonstration project purview?
Not to my knowledge, outside programs that subsidize private health insurance in the group market. I don't know.
I didn't hear that.
Oregon is the only state that subsidizes individual insurance. There are other states that do subsidize employer-sponsored insurance, but I don't know of any state, Representative Merkley, where a waiver has been granted that would, for the main portion of the Medicaid program, enable the state to give people a voucher and without defining a benefit package, as I understand your question, then let them go out and shop and see on the marketplace what health insurance they wanted. Not to my knowledge.
Mr. Chair, Utah waiver. I mean, it's certainly something dramatic. Is that a defined benefit, or is it a series of choices similar to what Representative Merkley was talking about? As far as I know, the only thing that comes close to what Representative Merkley was talking about was the group part of FEOP. But I'm really not all that familiar with the Utah waiver and their primary care package. Is it just one defined package, or do you know that?
Representative Cruz, Mr. Chair, I believe the Utah waiver does define the benefit package fairly specifically and sets out the benefits that are to be covered. The main difference between the Utah waiver and any other waiver I'm aware of is that Utah was allowed to exclude from the benefit package what used to be called a mandated Medicaid benefit hospital inpatient. But other than that, I think it does define the benefit package.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
That's the end of the summary, the recap of the major points from the last two presentations. I wanted to give you an opportunity, though, to ask for clarification on any of the sections that we've covered already, or to ask questions on anything that we haven't covered that you'd like us to pull together information on.
Me? Representative Cruz?
Yes, I guess I've talked to the chair about this. I information that I don't expect you to have right now, but we've talked a lot about the fact that various states have waivers that may be more innovative in some ways than ours, but I'm certainly interested in that. But what I'm also interested in is if there are other states that have been more aggressive and more innovative in what they have been allowed to use as match dollars for Medicaid outside of, I mean, we've got general fund and tobacco, and that's about the sum total of it. And I'm wondering if other states have gone beyond that and come up with creative ways, for example, to take funds from one place and roll them into general fund to qualify, and CMS has said that's okay. I mean, we can be creative as all get out, but unless CMS blesses it, OMB's not going to allow it. So, if there are some things out there that I don't want to reinvent a wheel if somebody else has already done it, but in the climate we're in now, we certainly need to be as aggressive as we can be at finding things that we can match. So,
having sat here for the last session, it sounds like there is a fair degree of interest in what other states have done.
Yes, absolutely.
In terms of their waivers and their funding, and perhaps what we could do is prepare a very brief summary of some of what's going on to help you.
I think that would be very helpful.
Yeah, I think particularly as it relates to the thrust of Representative Cruz's question, you know, what are they doing that we're not? What dollars are they getting? You know, especially when you start talking about, you know, our low reimbursement rates from the Fed level. I mean, in for penny, in for pound, we'll take all we can get. Representative Bates.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd ask that we might expand that question a bit, and I'll give you a couple of examples why. In the state of Washington, they've taken titling fees on cars. They take a $10 fee, four goes to the leader, six goes into a state fund for their trauma system. They then match that with federal dollars, and my understanding that in the Washington state, the best payer on trauma patients is the state Medicaid program. They pay better than commercial insurance does because they use that money to fund it, bring down the federal match, and put it through. So that's one program where they've done something innovative, and we're trying to bring legislation forward to match that in this state through a different method. The other thing, which is much more controversial, and the legality of it has to be done very, very carefully, and this is the part I asked you to expand and look into, is user fees. User taxes are commonly placed on the providers, physicians or hospitals. It's something that those groups have resisted for a multitude of very good reasons, but it is a possibility that some part of this could be funded that way, and that fee comes back into a fund which is dedicated for those groups, matched with federal funds, and goes back out. But it has to be done carefully, and the groups that would be affected by it have to agree to it, and has to come more from them than from us. But it's something we should at least know the background for and the legality of doing it, because if you don't do it just right, you run into federal difficulties.
Representative L.M. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am interested in, I'm not interested in litigation, but I want to be aware of if we cut back benefits, if we offer less benefits, et cetera, what impact is that going to have on those people? We live in a culture now where they expect health care services. And so I, especially with all the recent lawsuits with us, the decisions that we have made, I am very interested in making sure that we are very, very aware of what litigation could occur from any decisions that we may be making.
So let the record show, I think what Representative Anderson said is that when we get around to cutting eligibles and benefits, that we structure it to make sure we win any lawsuit. Is that what you did?
Right on.
Yeah, but I mean, but your point is very well taken. I mean, part of the challenge we face is a cultural issue. It's an expectations issue. I agree with you. I think that's a big part of the not only the politics, but the gestalt of this whole thing. It's a big deal. Representative Marks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and why shouldn't basic health care be a right in this country? But that's an aside for another talk. My concern.
If you want either of the two panelists to answer your question?
Well, if they've got that short answer and want to bring it back next
that's
time.
Yeah.
The question that I have, and I know a lot of people are concerned about the intersection of the Oregon Health Plan and long-term care issues. Particularly, I mean, we have a Medicare semi-system. As you pointed out, we do not have a system, but we have pieces, and we pick up a lot of costs for seniors because Medicare doesn't cover all the costs and doesn't cover the prescription costs at all. So it'd be nice to know kind of where our dollars are expending there, what we can expect as the federal government cuts back on Medicare, and is that going to cause an acceleration on our costs as well? So any kind of information along those terms, those kind of projections would be very helpful. Thank you.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a constituent call today who has severe handicap, and he was explaining to me that we have a demonstration waiver in OHP, but we also have other waivers, such as the one that allows us to spend money to keep people in their homes rather than being in a long-term care facility. And it would help this legislator if I could see a list of the waivers we currently have and what they do. Thanks.
And I would check with Jean because I asked for the same thing in my committee, and she may be working on that. So,
thank you. Mr. Berkovian.
Thank you, Chair. A while back, Congress was questioning some of the use of SCHIP dollars, coverage outside of children, and we've not heard anything of that lately. Can we get some update on just, is that kind of settled? Is that still an issue flying out there we need to be aware of?
Kobe, Mr. Chair, I think the dust has settled on that one. What we were hearing was that there were forces in Washington, D.C., that were very much opposed to the use of CHIP dollars to pay for health insurance for anyone other than children. And the reason that got a lot of attention was that the Health Insurance Flexibility Act, or HIPAA, opened the door to waivers from states that would use CHIP funds to pay for not just parents of children, but in some cases even adults who don't have children. So it was open wide enough that there were pressures back to narrow it and spend it only at least on families. I think that the countervailing pressure was that a number of states, Oregon included, have not been able to spend even most of the CHIP dollars allocated by the federal government on children, despite the fact that we've had enrollment into our CHIP program open for over 4 years now. So I think the flexibility is back in terms of allowing states to use those funds always assuming that the state continues to make that the CHIP funding available for children and never for anyone else unless it's also available for any children who may be eligible. And we've done that in our waiver.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Could CHIP dollars be used in the school systems for providing health care in the school systems? Or is it set up that that is an impossibility?
For safety net clinics is
for
where
safety,
I think you're going.
Safety net clinics?
Representative Anderson, we've looked into that. We ran into a barrier at the federal level. The CHIP legislation makes it very, very clear the federal government intends for those funds to be used to purchase insurance for children or for their parents. About two or three years ago, we asked if we could use some of those funds to pay directly to community-based clinics, and that would include safety net clinics and school-based clinics for services to children. Their response was that there was a limit on the use of federal funds for a combination of administration, patient education and marketing, and direct payments to community-based limits. And that limit was 10% of the total funding available, and we were already at 10% with patient education and outreach and administration. So they said unless we could fit it into that narrow corridor of 10%, they wouldn't let us spend the dollars in payments directly to the clinics.
Mr. Chair, yeah.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, then follow up, why couldn't we come up with an insurance plan or a managed care plan, and I think some already exist. I'm not sure if Care Oregon would be considered one, but and go that route. I mean, that's the insurance plan.
Representative Anderson, Mr. Chair, I think right now that's a much more promising approach. The federal government still seems to be determined that the funds will be spent to pay for insurance coverage rather than direct payments. But I think if you put together an insurance program that included in the provider network, the clinics of the kind that you're talking about, that would not be a problem.
And we could do that up to 10% of our...
Mr. Chair, that would be beyond the 10%. That 10% restriction was on direct fee-for-service payments to clinics.
So we could do the 10% and some utilization along
the line. Up to 100%.
Up to the full allotment as long as we did it through an insurance network, so to speak, an insurance program that included these clinics and the provider network.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to make sure I understand what you just said, I'm not sure that varies a great deal with what we're already available doing to us. We have plans that can pick these children up under our own Medicaid programs and fee-for-service. My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, the reason we've resisted that to a certain degree is the Woodwork effect. You bring these children in, which we want to do, and we have outreach programs to bring them in, and often their parents then qualify as adults for the Oregon Health Plan, and we can't afford them on the books also. Is that not a problem anymore? Am I missing this in my judgment on this?
Representative Bates, Mr. Chair, it is true in the experience of Oregon and other states that any time you do any marketing for a new program, you also get people who were already eligible for the current program but hadn't applied, if that's your point. So you could expect to see an increase in enrollment more broadly than just in the CHIP portion of the program. And it is true that currently there are children and their parents enrolled in programs in the Oregon Health Plan that include safety net clinics as part of the delivery system. So it's not that we're not already doing some of what Representative Anderson suggested. But I thought her question was that we would design, was it possible to design an additional program that would
satisfy the
that would feature, if you will, those clinics, the school-based clinics. And my answer was really just that I don't know of any restriction that would prevent us from doing that if we met the other conditions on CHIP funding.
Follow-up question, Chair. So are we talking about a system that potentially, as an example, in a school-based clinic, where the school-based clinic could access CHIP money, not on an individual basis for the students it deals with, but could ask for a capitated amount or some other amount based number of students they'd seen that qualified for SCHIP, and then they wouldn't have to bill the individual patient?
Representative Bates, that is what I'm saying. If the clinic were part of an insurance program that was satisfactory to the federal government, then you wouldn't be paying on an individual visit basis, but instead you would be paying for a benefit package that included services provided by those clinics.
Follow-up question? And that would be based on the number of students treated or capitated that qualified for SCHIP, do you think? I know you can't answer for the federal government, but we have a concept here I want to follow through with very carefully.
I appreciate that distinction, Representative Bates. I certainly can't speak for the federal government, but you're right. It would be under an insurance model on a capitation basis. There would be a payment to the insurance program that included these clinics for each child enrolled. What the federal government has been very reluctant to allow is direct payments on a visit-by-visit basis using CHIP funds. They would much rather have an insurance program that enrolled children into a benefit program that included the clinic services.
Mr. Chair.
One last question, okay, if I could, then I will leave you alone.
I like this.
Okay. Would you envision that the federal government might require a full panel for that, or would they be satisfied that these children receive their primary care at a school-based setting and would go ahead and give us a waiver to allow that to happen on a capitated basis? It might be a year-round clinic that I might have to have some qualifications to be open during the summer months for those children also.
Representative Bates, that's a fair question I can't answer. I don't know what the federal response to that would be.
Certainly worth exploring, though. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
And to recap that, what I'm hearing you say is, and in Bob's responses, is that that would have to be based on an insurance model, a capitated insurance model, where the enrollment of the school would provide the insured universe.
And it potentially could be statewide. Those schools that wanted to be involved in it could be involved with it, and it would be primarily for probably rural and low-income schools where they have enough FCHIP individuals that would make it worthwhile.
Right.
They could run their clinics based partially on that money, and it would be match money, but the match is like 70-30. And that match might not have to come from general fund money. The schools might be able to raise that themselves in some way. MUPL money flowing through schools could go directly to that kind of a program. Now, it wouldn't be MUPL money. It'd have to be general fund money or K-12 money.
Mr. Chair, it's an interesting concept, but would that mean that we'd have to do means testing of the students to make sure that only those qualified were receiving the services? I mean, you know, at this point, school-based clinics are available to students, and not all students are eligible for CHIP. So is this setting up a division here?
My guess, can we talk freely, Mr. Chair? My guess is that is already being done through the school-based lunch and breakfast programs. Those kids are basically, you have to be at poverty level. I imagine it's probably close to or the same criteria. This would only cover the payment the school would receive would be for the portion of the population that they have that would qualify, be my guess.
Okay, well, the rules around free and reduced are rather loose. And virtually anybody that shows up is getting breakfast or lunch. So my sense is that we might need to be a little tighter around something like this. I'm just asking the question.
Health centers where they exist are serving anyone at
right.
the school.
Right.
I think the issue is using, however, the school as a way to, in essence, be certain that every child that qualifies within the school becomes enrolled, mm-hmm. and then draw down the federal match. Whether the clinic continues to see children above a certain financial level really doesn't come into play, because the clinics continue to serve students regardless of their income, unlike the some of the lunch programs and others that I'm not as familiar with.
So basically, The argument would be that because the CHIP dollars are not funding the whole clinic, the assumption is that that those dollars match up to the portion of the clients served that are qualified. I guess I'm just wondering, I guess my assumption that the feds are going to be that loose in accounting is somewhat speculative, because normally they're not.
I think what perhaps what Representative Bates was alluding to is that the dollars wouldn't fund the clinic per se, but they would go perhaps into doing something such as purchasing health insurance, where then the clinic could be capitated, and those dollars then fund the clinic.
Yeah, they would fund that portion of the clinic. They wouldn't fund the whole clinic.
No.
Couldn't. But they would fund, as any health care provider, a portion of your income comes from a Medicaid program. This is becoming a Medicaid program coming into the health centers. The health centers probably have a disproportionate share of Medicaid eligible children, because
yes,
a lot of kids with good personal health insurance have a tendency to go to their own doctors, and they don't access the health clinics necessarily. So it's just a way, it's an innovative way of getting some income into those health centers, which they're for a service they're already doing and doing basically for free when they probably should have access to CHIP money.
So would it be safe to assume that in this model, if 40% of the students in that school were eligible, that 40% of the funds to operate the clinic could be CHIP dollars and no more? I mean, is this got to be a proportional thing?
Yeah, I would expect that let's say 40% of the kids in the school were eligible for CHIP money. They'd have to come in and be signed up individually and proven that they were eligible for CHIP money, and then they'd bring a capitated amount down for each one of those kids. It wouldn't necessarily be 40% of the cost, but it would be something coming in that wasn't there before and in legitimate money. Something that's legitimate for those kids to have. Otherwise, they're going to go out and see a doctor in the community if they get there. And the same thing will happen. CHIP money will be used again and matched to bring in a provider fee. But that provider fee now would go to the school.
Mr. Chair,
based off a relative value of the service, that unit list of the service provided, I think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Representative Cruz, but I think one of the areas you're having trouble getting your arms around this is how do you means test the kids?
Well, to a degree, and I worry about federal requirements for accounting. The new HIPAA regs have created a huge nightmare for everybody that's got to work in the system. I mean, it's kind of like, when the feds passed the paperwork streamlining thing a few years ago, and they created more paperwork in doing that. But HIPAA's kind of become a nightmare in and of itself, and so I guess I have concerns about how much administrative, how deep and steep and thick the hoops that we'd have to jump through are, and I mean, if this could be a fairly straightforward thing, it'd be great. But
Representative Cruz, Mr. Chair, I think it is fair to say that the federal government would require means testing of the students to be covered under any CHIP program, and also they would want the reimbursement to be on a capitation basis, since they would want it to be an insurance program. I think they would also want to certainly certify that the benefits to be covered were adequate, and they would want it to be broad enough that it wasn't simply the limited number of services that could be provided in a school-based clinic. I think it's safe to say they would want some other services to be provided as well. None of this means that you couldn't include school-based clinics as the outpatient location, clinic for care to be provided. But I think the point is that unless the federal government became very flexible indeed, I don't think that they would be favorable toward an application that asked for an insurance program that would only provide the services that could be provided at school-based clinics. I may be wrong about that, but I think that would be stretching the limits of the flexibility. But certainly they would have no problem whatsoever with school-based clinics being among the clinics that were participating in a program, receiving the capitation or a subcapitation based on the number of students at that school who were enrolled.
So it would need to be a larger safety net.
That's my guess.
Network, which I have no problems with.
Yeah, but part of a larger whole. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize the big issue is funding, but I wanted to throw another dimension into this, which is part of the challenge of the experience of the customer confusion over where to go and the paperwork that follows up on that. Recently had someone talk to me, not about Medicaid, but Medicare, and the enormous amount of paperwork that's following a procedure her father had an experience with my own daughter in an insurance world where a few hours in the hospital resulted in a wad of paperwork that it took many, many hours to sort out. And someone asked me, well, how do families deal with this who are dealing with the Oregon Health Plan and so on and so forth? I don't know if there's that element of challenge in the current design or not, but is that an issue in terms of the ability of people to access and utilize the health system, and is that a piece also that we could think about as we ponder how to restructure this if we do in fact restructure it?
Yes, I think that that's another one of those items that actually are a part of all places in our healthcare system. It's the complexity and the confusion that is a part of everywhere, whether we see physicians and hospitals complaining about it on the delivery side, we see patients complaining about it on the consumer side. This has become an issue, has been the amount of administrative confusion, whether it's about calling in to get an appointment or it's understanding your bill or whatever it is, it's whether it's enrolling for the Oregon Health Plan, whether it's signing up for your employer-sponsored health insurance. Terms are used that none of us understand. Even those of us in the business have difficulty sorting through bills. I get health insurance bills for every month, and I still look at them, and it takes me a while to decide, is this a bill? Am I being asked to pay something? Is it just a statement of a service that's been delivered? It's very confusing, and I do believe that this is a problem that needs to be addressed throughout the entire industry. It's not just the problem of Medicare or Medicaid. It's a pervasive problem, and the better job we can do in doing that, I think that the more satisfied both consumers, payers, and providers will be.
Let me go back to the issue we were talking about before in terms of the school-based clinic. It seems to me that there might be a backdoor benefit to this too, that if it was done on a monthly basis in terms of the those enrolled, while the students think they're indestructible and don't need medical care, the families might be interested in keeping their kids in school and putting pressures on to keep kids in school if it were a benefit that they wouldn't have otherwise.
Fair enough.
They're kind of mining this one pretty good. Any other questions on this subject? I don't want to move off it if there's...
Well, just one other thing, Mr. Chair. You know that our special ed dollars from the feds doesn't cover the services that we need that we're mandated to provide in the schools. And some of these children have skilled nursing in the school system. And I'm just wondering if this is another way to tap some more of those dollars that are obviously being needed for the children in the health care that really the schools are providing. So that's just one other point I wanted to make.
It's now on the list, and I'm understanding that really the issue is, and the question from everybody is, how can we continue to be creative and maximize our use of the SCHIP dollars.
And if you've got any good ideas that we're not plowing the field on, don't hesitate to bring them forward. The like I say, I'm not trying to rush us off this. If any other questions come up later on, don't hesitate to ask. But I've got a question as it relates to, you know, the fabled cost shift. If I'm an uninsured individual and I walk into the emergency room and I get $8 worth of service, assuming there was such a low-cost service, I get $8 worth of service, how much of that gets shifted to the commercial market? What? Is that an answerable question? And let me muddy the pond a little bit more. I mean, I get $8 worth of medical service. I get a dollar Band-Aid. Okay, so the administering of that, the recording and the booking, the inventory control, all that is more than a dollar, obviously. So if I got a dollar's worth of medical service, how much gets shifted to the commercial markets?
Mr. Chair, first of all, I think that's a tough question to answer. Secondly, I'll try and give you at least a partial answer.
Okay.
If, let's say that you're uninsured and you get care and you don't pay for it, and the cost of that care to whoever gave it to you is a dollar, that has to be picked up then by paying customers of the healthcare system. And they would pick it up in proportion to how much of the total bill they're paying. For example, if private insurance is paying 60%, let's say, of the total cost, it's not, but let's just for the sake of argument say that it is. It's actually lower than that because they don't have the very expensive Medicare, Medicaid folks. If it were 60%, they would pick up 60% of that dollar as an increased cost of the care that they pay for. And Medicaid would pick up its proportion and Medicare its proportion. But I guess the point is, if the cost of care is not paid for by the person who receives it, it has to be picked up by paying customers, or the provider simply absorbed the cost as a loss. But I think we can expect that it's going to be passed along to paying customers if it is the true cost of care.
Well, I mean, like you said, I was muddying the pond. If I got a dollar's worth, okay, here's the next part of that question. I got a dollar's worth of medical care. Hospitals out the buck worth of medical service. How much more, how many cents go on top of that for the administration, the management of tracking, inventorying, everything else associated with that dollar's worth of care? How much more of that, more than a dollar, is that? Translate, how much of the how much of that dollar, I got a dollar Band-Aid, what, or a 75-cent Band-Aid and 25 cents for the nurse or the doctor to slap it on my arm, how much more administration is there as it goes through the system before that can get shifted? See what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think that depends on the administrative overhead of
right.
the particular provider of the service. And some places provide services with much more administrative efficiency than others. I don't think that we can give you an exact, we can't quantify, we can look for the answer. But there's certainly an additional cost in trying to track that, administer that, recover it, et cetera. And so there's an additional cost. I think what happens is that any provider of care does what's, they look at their payer mix. And they look at which are the payers who pay that are meeting their costs, which are the payers that maybe are paying perhaps above what their costs are, and which are the payers that are paying below cost or none at all. And I think the costs get shifted. It's not just the person who's uninsured. It's the people that are insured who actually their insurance is not paying the cost of care. I mean, this is some of the issues around Medicare and Medicaid, that if it may not be, you may get a dollar Band-Aid from and be covered by an insurer who only covers 50 cents of that dollar Band-Aid, and another may cover the dollar. And those costs get shifted on as well. Eventually, the costs get shifted to that provider, that payer who pays the most. In many cases, actually, people who pay the most are people who pay out-of-pocket bill charges and who don't have a discount.
Well, which is what I want to get back to.
Yeah, it may not be the commercial insurer. It can actually be someone who pays out-of-pocket. Let me give you an example. Someone goes and gets a medical service and receives a bill. If they're in, and that bill is for $50 worth of service, that person may have insurance in which that insurance company has a contract to actually pay that provider of service $35. And that provider of service will get $35. If they're uninsured, they may get a bill for $50 and they'll be asked to pay $50 unless they negotiate some sort of a payment mechanism and some sort of a reduction in price. So it may not be just the insurer. It may not be a commercial insurer. It can be actually an individual who's chosen to self-insure who has that cost shifted onto them.
And that's fair. I understand that. I mean, it gets shifted to the commercial / private payer. Fine. And just for discussion purposes, let's say I've got my dollar worth of medical services, and it costs, you know, 25 cents to administer that shift through the process. What I understood you to say, Bob, was that that actually got shifted based on that given hospital's, quote, customer mix to the example you used, 60% to the commercial / private payer and the rest of whatever their Medicaid, Medicare is. How do they shift costs to someone that isn't paying a full reimbursement to begin with?
There you go. Well, I think the point is that what's not covered by the person receiving the service that's a true cost of care has to be picked up by someone.
Okay.
And to the extent, it's much easier to trace it, I think, if you're looking at the individual who comes in with no insurance, who's paying full charges with no discounts. But I think the cost shift, once it gets beyond that, pervades the entire system. And I'm not saying that you can find a line in a cost report for Medicare, let's say, that identifies cost shift. But when the hospital figures out how much it has to be paid to cover the cost of a bed day, it has to figure what its paying customer base is and what its true costs are, and then figure what it's got to be paid in order not to suffer losses that would mean it couldn't stay in business. So that missing payment has to be picked up someplace else in the system.
At the end of the year,
it's a zero-sum game, to use a, you know, off-quoted phrase. If it's a zero-sum game, I still don't understand how that shift, which I know occurs.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to tell me?
I think I can tell you.
Yeah. Okay.
I can tell you, Mr. Chair, I think I can tell where Bob kind of got off the track and to your question. I think he's thinking more globally than you and I. I'm thinking Oregon. He's thinking globally here. In Oregon, that dollar shift goes straight to commercial and private pay. And there's no place else for it to go because Medicare and Medicaid don't pay here.
Right.
In some states, Pennsylvania and others, some of that shift does go to Medicare because Medicare is the best payer in the system, and it pays above what the actual costs of that care are and allows them to have lower commercial rates as a result.
Right.
Right. But in Oregon, just talking about Oregon, that $1 goes straight over. Now, the other question you asked, though, was a tougher question.
$25
goes
straight over.
The other question you asked is how efficient are hospitals and doctor's offices? How, of actual care you receive, how much is overhead for all bunch of other things you have to do? And that's a whole different question, okay? And I would offer that because of the mandates laid on hospitals by the federal government, there are certain services that physicians and outpatient surgical centers and other things can do cheaper than hospitals can do it more efficiently. But it's not because hospitals aren't doing their jobs, it's because they've got mandates they can't get rid of. Horrible laws and a bunch of other things that we don't really want to go into, and you start charging us for what what our acronyms are, I'll leave the committee.
No,
okay.
We're not.
Thank you. Other committees may do that, but I can't afford the three committees.
We're getting coffee, and we're not charging for acronyms.
Thank you.
But hospitals raise their charge masters. Physicians raise their office fees. They say that at the end of the year they realize this is they need to raise their fees to bring in more revenue because they haven't been able to meet their costs. That then they then negotiate new contracts with insurers to say we now need to charge X amount more. The insurance company says okay. The insurance company then says we're going to have to pay more for the hospital care and or for the physician care, and the insurance company raises its premium, and then the insurance company passes it along to whoever is buying the insurance and says, now your premium is going up 10% this year. Why is that premium going up? It starts exactly where you started. It's starting at the bottom. No, costs are going up. People are not, at the end of the year, they look at how they need to increase their charges and maximize their reimbursement, and it keeps getting shifted on up. I think you were looking at the exact percentages. That would be tough to get at.
The real percentage I was after is how much of that dollar's worth of medical service plus whatever it costs to administer it gets shifted. And the answer for Oregon is 100%.
100%.
You've got it.
100%.
And that's in the commercial / cash payers private market.
Because Medicare and Medicaid, I think the thing we can probably all agree on is that, you know, Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement are really not meeting the cost of care.
Right.
Yeah, no, that I understand. So the hospitals are functionally made whole. One way or another, hospitals are made whole. Fair? Okay, but my first question is hospitals are made whole.
Yep. If they're not, they don't continue in business, Mr.
Right.
Chair. I think the assumption is that we've got hospitals and physicians' offices that continue over time by one way or another, getting enough money coming in to cover the cost of care that they're providing.
And the same with physicians is that they're subsidizing through commercial / private payers.
Right.
They're under cost-covered Medicare, Medicaid.
And there's another side to this, and that's the access issue, because part of it is the subsidy. The other is how then a business maximizes its payer mix. And I think you have to understand that because that's part of the dynamics. What you may do as a business, as either a doctor's office or a hospital, is to actually try and maximize the services that you provide to those people who pay the best and look at how you can get more of those people in the door. If you're continuing to lose dollars on one piece of the market, you can try and make up for that by perhaps seeing 10% of your business rather than 15% of your business to an unfavorable payer.
And then, if you live in a geographic area that has a large enough market of private / commercial payers.
Exactly. And there are some areas like that and some areas that are not like that. But that's the other piece of it. And so what this cost shift can also do is impede access as well, because if there are large numbers of favorable payers, they may, in essence, quote-unquote, crowd out unfavorable payers from getting care.
Right.
So it's an access issue as well as a reimbursement issue.
Well, I mean, they're kind of like...
Yeah, absolutely.
Representative Marshall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that I read some articles last year about physicians around the state deciding not to take Oregon Health Plan patients anymore. And I would picture that not so much that there were so many profitable folks, that they were crowding out the low-income folks, but simply that there weren't enough profitable folks in proportion, so that essentially the doctors said, we can't shift all of this missing cost onto our other clientele. And, you know, there are some hospitals that operate at substantial profits, and have profits to spare and can subsidize this, and there's other places that can't, and others that choose not to. But I think it'd be very useful if there was some kind if there's any sort of report about what percentage of the state is no longer served by doctors who accept Oregon Health Plan patients or Medicare patients, or anything that gives us a sense of kind of the contraction of available services. How big of issue is that, and is there any way that anything that we need to address the fact that it's more of a problem, since we are the low-cost payer in the system, it's more of a problem in rural areas than it is in urban areas, and is there need to be any sort of differential in the system that accounts for that in any way? That's just a question to throw out there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative March. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to complicate the cost reimbursement picture, I mean, if you picture a number of the hospitals in the state are nonprofit hospitals, and so the taxpayers are subsidizing nonprofit hospitals through property tax deductions, and they're also through charitable deductions. So the costs wind up getting spread back out to the taxpayers, if not through insurance, through property tax exemptions and or charitable exemptions as well.
Yeah, and I mean, just so the committee knows and those listening, I mean, we're just trying to pick on hospitals. Hospitals don't have a choice, you know, the patients they accept. Physicians do. And that's a significant difference and distinction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to point that out. I appreciate you doing it. I'd like to throw a couple more complications in there, some more facts that might make people feel a little bit worse, I suppose. In the past, Medicare patients have been pretty routinely taken in the state because Medicare broke even or paid a little more than cost, and it was worthwhile seeing them. Most physicians felt that they were reimbursed for their office overhead and for their personal fees. We're reaching a point in the state now with Medicare cuts that there are a significant number of physicians not taking Medicare patients anymore. And those patients in places like Medford are now going to emergency rooms for routine care and their follow-up care for their chronic illnesses, which is a terrible way to go about doing this. And that is just starting in the rural areas. It has not happened, I believe, in the large metropolitan areas yet, because risk models pay more, and probably hasn't started yet. The basis for pay to A and B hospitals has always been based on the fact they have a high Medicaid and Medicare population, and that to make the bottom line, they often have to pay the full cost. So that's an outlier to this, and one we have to keep in mind also. And one of the dirty little secrets about doctors that I always like to point out in public, because I'm a kind of a guy, I play both sides of the street, there are physicians in our state who I believe play the system. By that I mean we know that the commercial rates in the state are higher than they need for what you should get for your fees as a physician. So if you're really smart and want to play this and want to have a Bonanza King or whatever kind of plane you want and three different cars, you cannot take Medicare patients, not take Medicaid patients, and only take commercial patients if enough of them around, and run a country club practice where you can make a very nice income because you're being paid more than you normally would be, because those fees for the commercial market have been set based on expected cost shifts into the Medicaid and Medicare program. So if you're really smart, that's what you do. I don't think it's a good social conscience, but it's the way you can play the game if you want to. And that does go on in the state, unfortunately. I don't think it's a common practice. But I've always felt that a pay-or-play system would be much better, that if you don't take Medicaid, you don't take Medicare, that's okay. You should pay a penalty for that because your fellow physicians are picking up your load.
And it gets back to the basic issue we talked about last time, which is somebody gets sick. They fall and they break their leg, or they get pneumonia. They go to a doctor, a hospital. They get a service. That's going to be the same service regardless what your insurance coverage is. If you break your leg, you're going to get the same x-ray. You'll get the same cast. You'll get treated in the same way. But depending on what kind of insurance you have, that provider will get paid any multitude of ways. It's as if you went into a restaurant and ordered a hamburger, and different people paid 14 different prices for that exact same hamburger cooked in the same way. It's the same service, and people are getting paid very differently, and that really greatly complicates things.
Representative Anderson, this is Gordon.
I've been called worse. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems to me that I'd hate to penalize people. It seems to me better to incentivize them. And while I don't understand yet the revenue implications, it might be possible to reimburse some of the physicians that are willing to take large amounts by tax credits proportional to the amount of Medicare and Medicaid or Oregon Health Plan they take. Just possibly making it feel a little bit more level, but I don't know how much revenue would be taken away.
How much, again, maybe a dumb question, providers write off in terms of loss when they, again, don't get paid for services? Might be a question for the doctor. I mean, is it a negligible amount? Is it in terms of a tax write-off? Does in essence, if a lot of losses occurred, does it get passed on basically and lost revenue to the state, for example? Do we know? Is it an issue?
Could you clarify the last part of your question?
Well, do providers of any type actually write off loss on their taxes, for example, and get some sort of break on it? I don't know. I'm not a tax person. And
why wouldn't they? Mr. Chair? We would love to do that, but there's some IRS complications. They won't let us do that. If I could write off my Medicaid and Medicare losses against my actual costs, it would, on my personal income tax, it'd be very nice. But you can't do that because you're making a profit overall, and it's part of what your payer mix is. And
but so can't you reduce your profit? I mean,
it reduces my profit, all right.
Right, okay, yeah. But
does that very nice
easy numbers. I mean, you're, one-man shop, and your total gross revenue is $500,000, and your profit is, 25 cents.
Yeah, there we go.
your profit is $100,000, let's say, your gross profit. You cannot document that, okay, I saw Oregon Health Plan patient A, and I lost $30 on that visit. Doesn't that reduce your gross profit to a net profit, say down to $50,000, and you pay taxes on your $50,000?
I have had long discussions with my accountant of why I can't. He's told me why I can't do that. Most people are in a passive situation where whatever you see is what you take as your salary, you pay your taxes on, and you can't go back and deduct your Medicaid and Medicare losses against that. And that's all I'm not an accountant, I can't say, but I've had the discussion long and hard, and I think every doctor in the state probably has been told, you just can't do that. You have to pay taxes on what your income is.
But your professional corporation, okay, is showing a loss then.
It
passed through to you under a sub-edison pass-through structure is a salary.
Yeah, the corporation zeroed out at the end of the year, and then the pass-through is whatever your salary is. And so you don't take a deduction against those Medicaid losses.
Only actual expenses.
You have a series of expenses. You have this much income. You subtract one from the other, and that's what your salary is. It's a wash. So, but you can't then go back. I often ask, if I'm willing to take up the burden of Medicaid and I've reduced my income by $30,000, can I take that as a tax deduction on my IRS form when the next guy on the street doesn't do it? And they tell me, no, you've made that choice to see Medicaid patients, and you can't go back and take it against your personal taxes. That's what I've been told. And I'm not an accountant, but that's what I've been told. Annually, I'd point out.
The cost of the Band-Aid is a supply, but his time's gone.
I mean, that's
good thinking. I mean, if you actually could do that, it would revolutionize how you deal with Medicaid and Medicare patients, obviously.
And that's a federal issue. But how about for Oregon?
talk to an accountant. I really can't answer that question.
Nor can I
qualify to.
Four profit hospitals are in the same situation, basically, then.
Whether you could allow a tax credit or a tax deduction for the amount of Medicaid patient taking an organ, I don't know. That's probably a reasonable question to ask. I just don't know.
Representative Morgan.
I'd kind of like to pursue this a little bit more. I would go back to just a regular business model. So if you were selling washing machines and you had a fixed cost in the cost of selling a washing machine, and you sold the washing machine for two-thirds of that amount, or you sold the washing machine and the customer never paid you, you could write that off as a bad debt. Why isn't that concept applicable to fixing a broken leg or taking out an appendix or something like that?
Talk to my accountant. I've had that argument with him for forever. He says the IRS doesn't allow it.
Let me go back. Having been a small businessman and consulted with them for years, they if you're selling a washing machine for $200, you can't, and somebody walks out the door, bought the washing machine, and never pays you, you don't write off $200 loss. You write off what it cost you, not your profit. You only write off your cost.
Okay.
You don't get to write off, oh, well, you know, it took me 5 minutes to sell that person, or 25 minutes. Or if you send somebody out to service the machine and you don't, they don't pay you for the service call, you know, you may have the overhead. I mean, if you did it yourself, you went out yourself, you just didn't get paid. You know, you write off the parts and the mileage, but you don't get to write off that your lost time.
That's right. And so you can't write off your employee's lost time that delivered it to the house.
I mean, you deduct their time, and that's a cost of business.
That's a cost of business, yes.
Period. Whether they collect or not.
Well,
if you sell watches, you get to write off the time.
No. Oh, the time of the employee who sold it, yes.
But that's whether you collect or not.
But that's overhead time.
Yeah, that's overhead.
But doctors don't get to do that.
Not for themselves.
It's in the bottom. Yeah, they write out. I mean, yeah, they, I mean, if they're paid hourly, yeah, sure.
I wonder if anybody's in revenue is watching us right now. Help out a little bit.
Where's Lane Shetterly?
I think.
Eat him, that's right.
And Lane, don't ever ask any stupid questions like that again.
Jeez. Mr. Warner, if you're up there, would you please come down here?
If I can throw in a last comment on this piece.
Sure.
I'll muddy it up completely. I think that commonly the way it works is you have a receivable, and what you're writing off is the receivable when it's uncollectible. But that puts you back into the position, exactly the position that a doctor is in. I mean, had Dr. Bates written a receivable for the difference between what he was being paid and what it should have cost, if you will, but he doesn't get paid that, he'd be then writing off the receivable, and that's exactly the position he is in now. So in essence, it's not that different.
Well, but I mean, here is a situation where you have an institutionalized loss, and everyone knows it. I mean, a systemic loss built into the system. That's what you've been arguing for years. The documentable, I would assume. And that's what I think the difference is. I mean,
that's subjective. What is real is what he pays for whatever it is that he purchases, as far as the goods and the time of his employees and stuff like that. Same as with Susan's washing machine. The only thing that's substantiated is what she paid for the washing machine. She could have, she could sell it for whatever. But if it's not collectible, it's not collectible. It's all blue sky at that point. So, otherwise she could say, they didn't pay me for it, and that was the $1,000 washing machine, even though I only paid $150 for it. So, that's just the way the IRS works.
Well, considering the fact that Scott Gallant's in the room, I want to go on record saying I am totally opposed to doctors being allowed to sell washing machines, because I'm
but the way things are going, we'll soon be doing that.
Or at least doing one.
We soon could be forced to.
Any other questions? I've enjoyed this today thoroughly. I think it's a good line of questions, good presentation.
Are the cost of washing machines covered under Medicaid? We never did.
If they're washing,
surgical blankets, you know. The anyway, I've enjoyed this thoroughly. I appreciate very much the generosity of your time and talents coming to the committee. We might need to call you back.
Anytime.
We hope you will. We'll try and get you the answers to the questions.
Yeah, we ask easy questions. So,
so Mr. Dupree, Dr. Goldberg, thank you very much.
Our pleasure.
Sincerely. Tomorrow, we're going to be graced by the good efforts of Rocky King, who's with us today, who's been watching some of the testimony. We'll start down on the private side and FIAT, spending as much time as we need to on that. Any other statements or business to come before the committee? We're adjourned.
Now that you're adjourned, I can tell you my doctor and plumber joke.